Greetings.
Welcome back.
Welcome to Free Thinkers. We're a group here at the church that believes in free inquiry and not accepting credo or orthodoxy, but finding out for ourselves what gives. And if you agree with that, maybe you're a closet free thinker. Who knows? Our next session, by the way, is in 2 weeks, and we're going to have a session on Cuba. And we have two people here in the audience who are going to conduct that session. One is Lou Altman, retired lawyer. And Lou recently made a visit to Cuba. And the other is Monty Hayes, a retired journalist. Monty, there he is, who for 23 years was the Associated Press Bureau Chief in Lima, Peru, and who knows Latin America probably better than anyone at our church. But today, we have a distinguished speaker, Joe Carrotta, who's going to talk to us about evolution. Joe is, he taught advanced biology in Ohio for 30 years, and currently he teaches at the Academy for Lifelong Learning. He has a degree from Ohio State. He is a Princeton University Woodrow Wilson Fellow in Bioethics. He was a recipient of numerous awards, including Ohio Teacher of the Year. And he traveled and studied in Kenya, Peru, Costa Rica, and Galapagos. In addition, he's an accomplished actor. He appeared in over 50 stage productions. And in fact, right after this, he and his wife, Lynn, are going to Oslo to do a three-act comedy. So please join me in welcoming Joe Carrotta.
Okay, how's that? Oh, wow. Listen to me. I love that. That's great. I'm just amazed, and I love this. Every time, I'm so sure that I made the right choice by moving to Sarasota 9 years ago. Friday morning, May, sun is out, 85 degrees, and we have a room full of people coming to hear me talk about evolution of all things. That's amazing. I love it. What a great place. In a free thinkers group yet. Wow. Right choice, okay? Anybody, I put this up there earlier, does that ring a familiar bell with anybody at all? I know that's an accent because some people have been in my class already. It rings a very familiar name with me because when I was in junior high, my older brother was in high school and he had his high school biology book that I just love this thing. There it is. I got a copy on the internet for a dollar or whatever, and the authors are Moon, Otto, and Tal. And so just maybe to jog your memory a little bit, you probably might remember these guys. Remember those kinds of little overlays? Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, I remember those. Okay, and there's another one with the human body, and I'm not going to show you that one, okay? But the reason why this is so significant, especially to the topic today, is that this textbook, due to a really strange anomaly in choosing textbook in the United States, this textbook was actually the textbook that was used from about 1924 until the early 60s. Now, if you know anything about textbook selection, it's happening right now in Texas. And it's always Texas. I love Texas. I don't like the way they choose their books. There's a committee of about four or five people. They look at the books. Right now, the head of the, you're familiar with what's going on with their history selection, the head of their history textbook selection committee is a used car salesman. That's his expertise in the field. And of course, if you read about it, they're doing revisionist history with history. Well, in biology, the same thing happened. And especially back in the 20s, you weren't going to have a separate textbook for Massachusetts and a separate one for Texas and a separate one for Ohio. So basically, since Texas bought their books for the entire state, that's a big chunk of books. Whatever Texas chose, pretty much the rest of the country had to use. So that's what they picked. And I'm not going to entirely trash this book. It's a nice book. It had great pictures of dinosaurs in it that I used to look at. I remember when I was a kid. And I love those overlays. They're a lot of fun. But if you had to pick up a current textbook today, you'd find that it was a lot different. 1973, there was an essay written by Theodore Dobzhansky, the famous biologist. And the title of this essay, it was for the American biology teacher, the title of this essay was, Nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution. That's how, and by the way, Theodore was a very religious scientist, by the way. That's how strongly he felt about incorporation of evolution into biology textbooks. Contrast that with the fact that this book, the most widely used book from 1924 up until the early 60s, does not mention the word evolution in it at all. It's not in here. There's a chapter, chapter 53 on page 655, that's called The Changing World of Life. Do you have any teachers in here? Okay, you know. That's okay, whatever. Nobody ever gets to chapter 53, right? It's there, it's nice, but we never really get there. So, but as a result of that, unfortunately, again, from 1924 to early 1960s, we got ripped off. This was not included in our biology curriculum. I never had it in high school. I went to a private school. So, where does our knowledge of evolution come from? We kind of know what it is. We read the papers. Some you might read scientific journals and things. But basically, for most people, it's a self-taught topic. And for most people, unfortunately, they kind of know what it is, but they're not really sure. That's where I come in. Because my job is, I teach at the Academy of Lifelong Learning. My job is, hey, I know you didn't get it the way you should have in high school. I taught it for 30 years in high school. I'm going to just tell you what it is. So that's what I'm going to do today. Right? So I'm going to sort of fill in the gaps between what we missed and what we're going to have today. Maybe it's funny because I had a lot of people ask, so what are you talking about today? Oh, evolution. Maybe I'm a little naive, but I'm really always amazed when somebody says, how do you feel about teaching such a controversial subject? And my answer to that is always the same. In science, there is no debate over the acceptance of evolution. Let me just say that again. In science, there is no debate over the acceptance of evolution. So I never get involved in debates. What my job is to teach about evolution and natural selection. I wouldn't debate any more than I'd go to the Flat Earth Society and debate the roundness of the Earth. Debate's something I never studied. I never was on the debate team. I do know that some of the ways a debate works is that you make your argument by making the other person's argument weaker, but you don't ever really have to prove anything on your own, which is some of the tactics that are used today. Last summer, Lynn and I were going past a church in northeast Ohio, and she said, we should go there. There's a sign there that said, tonight, 7:30, God versus Darwin. Is it a wrestling match? But I saw that, I said, I think I know where the smart money is in that particular venue. I don't get involved in debates. In science, we don't have a debate to decide how many chromosomes we've got. If we have a large vocal segment of the population that decides that 46 is an unpleasant number, all right? You don't debate things like that. And part of the problem is that we have the media is trying to be fair, the fairness doctrine, and in order to promote that, what they have is they try to present equal sides to each argument. Well, in this particular argument, the sides aren't equal. The weight of evidence supporting evolution vastly outweighs any evidence that is anti-evolution. But if you get all your information from watching TV, you would never know that. If you get it from reading the newspaper, you would never know that, because it's always pro-con. Hey, they must be equal. Let's decide. No, you don't get to decide if there's gravity or not. Right? It's there. So there's not two equal sides to every single argument. I mean, in science, the fairness doctrine comes in. If you have an idea that's not supported by experimentation, we toss it out. If you can support it with the experimentation and get it accepted by the scientific community, yeah, we'll take a good look at it. We'll talk about that in a bit, though. Along the course of all this, I also have several pet peeves, and they sort of They come into why there are misconceptions with the general public about the topic of evolution. And a lot of it has to do with terminology. One of the words that has different meanings in different settings is the word change. Things change. Things have changed throughout time. You know, the Earth, the Grand Canyon, animals, man. The fact that things have changed is not an issue. There's, like, again, overwhelming evidence that things have changed. What is debatable is how things change. And this is what, as we as scientists look at it. I mean, you could use the word in a lot of contexts. I changed my habits. I changed my tires. I got changed for a dollar. Now, today, the fact that life has changed through time is fairly well accepted, but this wasn't always so. Up until the mid 1700s, there was very little idea that things have changed. People believed that things were static. That's the idea that was imprinted for a couple thousand years of education. So it's a relatively new idea. The word evolution, in its simplest definition, just means change. We'll talk a little bit about how things change. Now, in a biological sense, we are not concerned with small changes that take place during the life of an organism. That's not the kind of change we're talking about. So when I say I change my habits, that's not evolution. The biological definition is, the definition that I use, is evolution refers to genetic changes in a population over the course of many years. So there's something involved, genes are involved somehow, and time is involved, and populations. You know, that doesn't say individual. This is in regards to populations. What it is not, and again, I have some conversations with people about this. Oh yeah, well, you're trying to tell me that life just sprang up from nothing? No. You're trying to tell me that life in the universe just sprang up from nothing? No. Here's what evolution is not. Okay. Evolution has nothing to do with the origin of the universe. Nothing. It is not concerned with the origin of the Earth. Right? People hypothesize about this, but this is not what evolution is about. It's not concerned with the origin of life on Earth. I don't know where the first life came from. There are hypotheses out there. That's not what evolution is. It's not concerned with changes that occur during a lifetime of an organism. And it's not the same thing as natural selection. Actually, natural selection, which I'm going to be one of my get to shortly, is how evolution works. But it's not the definition of what evolution is. So those are some things that it is not. Another term that gets tossed around a lot, and again, misuse something like the word change, is the word adapt. I can adapt during my lifetime. For instance, I could put on a nice shirt and a sport coat and adapt to the surroundings and fit into a room full of intelligent people until I start talking. I have adapted during my lifetime. I've adapted to new bosses. I've adapted to new jobs, new neighborhoods, new classes every year when I'm teaching. You put on an overcoat to adapt to the cold. Those are small changes that take place during your lifetime. But in biology, here's what adaptation means. Again, time is a big factor here. So in biology, evolution, adaptation is the evolutionary process by which a population becomes better suited to its habitat. Let's look at exactly how it becomes better suited, but we'll get to that in a second. This process takes place over the course of many, many generations. So it's, you know, when they say, oh, I put on, this animal is adapting to its environment, well, that's short-term adaptation. That's not biological adaptation. The other big thing that always comes up, how many times, I was talking to a group on Wednesday, and it wasn't about this topic. As a matter of fact, I told somebody I was coming here to talk about evolution. At Linda's table, she said, one of the women said, so do you believe in evolution? And I always ask them to restate the question, please. Okay, because, no, I don't believe in evolution. It's not a matter of faith. Keep that in mind. It's a tricky little thing, but no, I don't believe in it. I don't believe that the Earth is round. Earth's round. I don't believe in gravity. There's gravity, all right? Evolution falls into the same category. You know, science assumes that the universe is explainable without appeals to supernatural events. That's what science is. And religion is a little different. It's a system that's rooted in faith, and it has some basis in the supernatural. The domain of science, I think I have a... yeah, I do. The domain of science is the empirical constitution of the universe. Empirical, based on facts, based on experimentation, based on observation. And those two domains don't overlap. Look, the domain of religion, search for practical ethical values and the spiritual meaning of our lives. That doesn't mean you can't be an ethical scientist, but what it means is that if you're exploring religion, you're exploring science, overlapping those two gets you into trouble because science can't rely on supernatural explanations. And then it becomes non-science. So, you know, over the years, Jim just asked me earlier, he said, have you had students say, have you gotten into trouble with students over the years? And I said, yes, I've had some students come up to me and say, look, I'm not going to do well on this test, on this evolution thing, because I don't believe in it. And I'd say, well, you're a really nice kid, but I really don't care what you believe. I want you to be able to tell me what evolution is. That's what the National College Board is going to ask you. That's what my job is, to teach you what it is. Your beliefs are something else. And I told them this, even sometimes I did write this nice essay and explain natural selection at the end. They go, but I still don't believe in it. and that's okay. Because we used to, you know, when we were talking about the constitution of the universe or the constitution of the natural world in the past, for most of our natural history, it was based on belief systems. You know, think about it. What did the thunder used to mean? What did rain used to mean? You know, what did death used to mean? We had supernatural explanations for it. Now we're getting a little bit better at making some scientific explanations for a lot of these things. Brings me to another misused term, which is theory. Again, what do I hear a lot? Evolution is only a theory. Oh, gosh, it's the title of this speech, isn't it? I hope everybody knows here that it was ironic. Yes. Yes, that's why the question mark was in it. Yeah. So people say, it's only a theory. There's lots of theories. Why don't we challenge our students? Teach them all the theories and let them make up their own minds. Teach the controversy. From this great little cartoon, I don't know if you can read this or not, but I'll read it if you can't. The little girl says, now the quickest way to go home is to float across this ravine, and I believe we can do that. And her buddy the horse says, oh, so you can just dismiss gravity? And she says, yep, I say it's an unproven theory, and that's been shoved down our throats in science class. And he says, so how are you going to disprove it? She said, that's where you come in. I love that. So, you know, when we say theory, what is a scientific theory? Well, the word theory in common usage, usually when people are talking about theories, like, I have a theory about why she left him. No one really knows the reasons. It's kind of like you can kind of guess. It's sort of like a hunch. Those are not theories. Those are hypotheses. Right? Hypothesis. You might have some factual basis for them, but that's just a hypothesis. When I use the word theory in science, and when I write it, I always write it with a capital T, because theory in science, it's sort of like the Holy Grail. It's one of the ultimate things that you're shooting for in science. When scientists speak of the theory of evolution, cell theory, theory of gravitation, they're talking about scientific concepts that are so thoroughly tested over decades and centuries that they're very, very unlikely to change. In science, it can change. If somebody was to disprove it, that would be like winning the lottery. I mean, there's guys, yes, I disproved it! And I guarantee you'll be on the front page of every scientific magazine in the world. But you have to do some pretty good homework to disprove it, right? Because when you've got several hundred years worth of evidence on your side and experimentation has been done already, you have to come up with something pretty good to knock that down. Well, so it's a result of, again, of decades, sometimes even centuries of hard work. A theory is an explanation of a natural phenomenon, as opposed to a fact, which is a confirmed observation. theories explain hundreds, matter of fact, hundreds of thousands of facts. To a scientist, a theory is more important than a fact because it incorporates facts and explains them. So this business about, oh, it's only a theory, well, here's some other only theories. None of these is small. The atomic theory says that everything's made up of atoms, basically. Cell theory, all living things are made up of cells. Chromosome theory, the genes are in cells and they contain DNA. Electricity is a theory. We talk about it as being something, yes, real, but it's a theory. It's a very good theory. Evolution is a theory. Germ theory, this is one of my favorites because whenever I was asked if I would include something like intelligent design, you're going to teach both sides of the issue when you're teaching evolution, I would say, yeah, sure, I'll be happy to do that. As long as when I'm teaching about diseases, I can include demonic possession as an alternate explanation. to germ. They didn't like that. The Earth going around the Sun is a theory. Plate tectonics, that's a relatively new theory. It's only 30 years old. We consider it a fact because, again, it's such a strongly based theory that people talk about it like it's a real thing, and it is. Relativity, I'm not going to touch that one. I'm just, sorry. Because some are easier to explain than others, and I guess that's what relativity is, right? So here's some of these words that I just threw around. So theory, well-documented explanation of some aspect of the natural world. It may incorporate hypotheses, laws, and facts. Hypothesis is a little bit less. Actually, you'd probably start with a hypothesis if you wanted to make a theory. Collect a lot of evidence, do a lot of experimentation, and then possibly propose a theory after a long period of time. And facts are just observations that have been repeatedly confirmed. if I haven't made this clear, evolution is as thoroughly documented as any one of those other theories that I put up there. It's very, very strong. So, what is the theory, Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection? I'm going to briefly try and hit some of the high points just in case, again, if you were in that era from 24 to the 60s and you didn't get it in school, let me just briefly explain the how of evolution, which is natural selection. It depends on a couple of observations and a couple of conclusions. And starting out, the first one, this actually came from Thomas Malthus. And his hypothesis was that populations grow geometrically, which means the power to produce offspring grows very fast, whereas the power to produce food grows a little bit slower. And he actually called them geometric and arithmetic progressions. Let me just show you on a graph what that means. So, oops. The green one is population growth. Starts out kind of slowly and then zips up. And this represents the ability to produce food. And you can see that right here, there's going to be some trouble. This is where the population starts out growing its food supply. Now, that's observation number one. Real simple. Population grows faster than food does. That's the first of the observations. But right away, secondly, is another observation from just observing creatures in the wild, and that is that you don't have this. You do not observe this happening very often. I always talk about the lemmings as one of those anomalies. But aside from that, in nature, you don't have these incredible population spurts going up like that. Instead, something happens like here's the population. It hits a point where it starts to increase, and maybe it does that. Maybe it might go up and down a little bit, but basically it levels out. So populations tend to stay stable. That's number two. Number three. Okay, why does this population level out? Well, we mentioned one thing already. That's food. There's food is a limiting factor for a population. What are some other limiting factors? Well, it depends where you are. In some places, it might be predators. You know, how good are you from getting away from predators? It might be the amount of water that's around or the quality of the water that's around. If you're a plant, it could be how accessible is light to you. Space can also be one of these factors that causes a population to level out. So, number three, just says that limits on population growth prevent organisms from surviving to reproductive age. So, I mean, that's the key here. The whole key to this whole thing is for a population to go on, it has to be able to survive long enough to reproduce. If it hits reproduction age and it makes offspring, it's fulfilled its job. But if something in the environment stops it, that means that particular organism isn't suited for that particular environment. And this is also key, that these limits change with changing environments. So it's not always, you know, this whole only the strong survive. It really, really bothers me, because strength isn't always the factor. Sometimes it's speed, sometimes it's smartness, sometimes it's color, sometimes it's, you know, the ability to grow taller. But it does have to be fit within that particular environment. Then the last two. The last two really tie it together. Again, this is just an observation. When you look at a population means a bunch of organisms of the same species that can reproduce among themselves and produce fertile offspring. There is variation. Look around. All right, we're all the same species. Everybody looks a little bit different. We have different sizes. We have different smarts. We have different skin colors, skin shades. So all that, just variation. And any population of animals, this is the same. You'll find variation. And this is the beauty. It's so simple that it's just beautiful. I love beautiful, simple things, and this is one of them. This statement ties it all together, this last statement. Very simple. This is what natural selection is. Organisms with favorable variations survive, given enough time and a changing environment. On the opposite side of that, organisms that don't have favorable variations may not survive. So who's doing the selecting? Nature. That's why they call it natural selection. What determines on whether you're going to get selected or not? Your characteristics. Where do those characteristics come from? Your genes, genetics. See? So, and to carry this out just a little bit further, because Darwin's book was titled, his first book was entitled Origin of Species. Let's say you had a population right here. And the population started spreading out, physically, just started spreading out over a bigger range. This part of the population, nature started selecting for different characteristics, maybe different coloration, maybe different strength or speed or whatever. This side of the population started getting selected a little bit differently too. As they started moving away from each other, if there was some sort of a geographical separation between the two, where they weren't continually going back and forth and interbreeding, that under certain conditions, these over here, if you continue to be selected for by nature, and these continue to be selected for by nature, 1 million, 2 million, 3 million years later, if you take one of these and put them together and play some soft music, they may not be able to mate anymore. That means they have become different species. That's what speciation means. So the origin of species means it involves first this one population, it involves a separation, different natural selection on two parts of the population, and then finally to a point where they can't get back together again. Let me give you some really quick, simple examples of this. By the way, Darwin never used the terms higher and lower. He also, in his first draft of the book, didn't even use the term evolution, because the word evolution at his time implied progress. That wasn't part of what, you know, his whole concept and our whole concept today of evolution has nothing to do with a ladder, something being better than something else. It's a branching bush that goes on off in all directions. And that bush has been pruned millions and millions of times. The prunings are extinctions. And the new branches are new directions, new species, okay? So here's a true story. It's not a real happy story, but it's a true story of, you probably heard this before. I was told this by my parents. It's a story of a Benny bacteria. Benny this is a colony of bacteria. There's 10, you could probably, if you count them up, there's 10,000 of them there, okay? Take my word for it. Of these bacteria. And as you can see from the picture, that every one of those bacteria in that colony are all perfectly 100% identical to each other. Except for Benny. Benny was different. As a different bacteria, he did not have a happy childhood. They wouldn't sit with him at the cafeteria. He couldn't go to prom. He had a pretty miserable existence being made fun of by the other bacteria. Benny's different, Benny's different. Until one night, like a great wind, the petri dish in which they were living, someone put some penicillin on it. And every single one of those bacteria, because penicillin kills bacteria, right? Every single one of those bacteria was killed. Except for Benny. That's how Benny was different. He happened to be born with a resistance to penicillin. And within a few hours, since bacteria reproduction is pretty boring, they split in half, you know, it's asexual. After a few hours, Benny started reproducing and making an entire brand new colony of 10,000 more bacteria that were all exactly identical to each other. What? Except for Betsy. Betsy was different. Betsy didn't go to prom. Nobody would sit her at the cafeteria table. She had a miserable existence until one day, like a great wind, somebody put a double dose of penicillin on this petri dish and it wiped out the entire colony. Can you tell where this is going? Wiped out the entire colony until no one was left except for Betsy, and on and on and on and on. You can do this in your own labs at home, boys and girls. Matter of fact, in underground bunkers, people are doing this right now. They're taking anthrax, for example. They're hitting it with an antibiotic. They're taking the survivors out. Where do those survivors come from, anyway? Accident. They just, if they all get wiped out, there's no variation that saved them. You still have to have that one survivor. So they'll take those survivors, put them in a new petri dish, let them grow, hit them with a double dose. Take out the survivors, put them in a new petri dish. When people say there's no evolution, let me tell you this. Since we started using penicillin for syphilis, for example, today you have to use 7 times the original dose of penicillin because the syphilitic bacteria keeps on, it's doing exactly what I showed you here. But that's natural selection. So it's the simplest example of natural selection. I can give you another one with some pictures on it real quick. It might be easier to see. There is the Hebert squirrel. Hebert squirrel lives on the south rim of the Grand Canyon. And millions of years ago, there were lots and lots and lots of these squirrels. And about 5 million years ago, this little creek started winding its way through and started making, it was called the Colorado Creek. And as it started wearing its way through the sediment deeper and deeper, it separated the squirrels that were living on this side of the creek from this side of the creek. It's exactly the story I told you earlier. And, of course, that became the Colorado River. It became the Grand Canyon. Today, if you go to the Grand Canyon, the south rim is totally different from the north rim. The climatic conditions are different. The vegetation is different. The predators are different. And the squirrels are different. This is the Kaibab squirrel. The Kaibab squirrel is what happened to the Hebert squirrel on the north end. Today, if you take an Hebert squirrel and a Kaibab squirrel and you put them together, different species. Took 5 million years to happen. By the way, it sounds like a long time. 5 million years in geologic time is nothing. It's nothing at all. So that's natural selection. Sorry. You can observe it today. It's happening all the time. It's happening right now. They're observing a species of walking stick that's evolving because some live on one color plant versus another color plant, and some are getting picked off by birds and others are not. Time-wise, if you're talking about fish, this might take 60 or 70 years to get a new species. That's not a very long time. Mice, a little bit longer, a few hundred years. Insects, a couple of generations. Bacteria, it could be a matter of hours. What do all those things have in common? They have real high reproduction rates. With animals that have a slow reproduction rate, we're pretty slow, it would take a much, much longer time. Now remember, we've only been around, Homo sapiens, under 100,000 years. So that's nothing. And these, we're talking about 5 million years. We haven't been around for any time at all. So what are, having gone through what natural selection is and how most people don't really understand these facts about natural selection, when people talk about, I don't buy this evolution thing because, they usually have some misconceptions about it. So I'm going to show you some of the common misconceptions. Common misconception, evolution has never been observed. Well, I just gave you two or three really good examples that you could say, yes, it has been observed. It's been observed in the lab, it's also been observed in the wild. Something else that's kind of important here is that evidence isn't limited to what you can see with your eyes. There's enormous, matter of fact, the evidences that I told you about with the squirrel and the bacteria, those are like minor evidences. The major evidence is right here. The chemistry, the biochemistry of these things shows how closely things are, how closely things are related, and how far apart they're related. They even can sort of predict when things split off and became other parts of the branches now. But the evidence supporting evolution, again, based on fossils, comparative anatomy, biochemistry, is absolutely overwhelming. It's a no-brainer. Number two, I've heard this one from people who, again, aren't really sure about the about this law. They say that evolution violates the second law of thermodynamics, which, you know, pretty much says that everything's falling apart. You always have disorder occurring, entropy. In other words, why would things all of a sudden become more organized on this planet? And the answer to that is it's just a misapplication of the second law. First off, order in nature is very common. You see it happening all the time. Snowflakes are an ordered piece of water, if you will. But the key to it is right here, that the planet, our Earth, is not a closed system. The second law of thermodynamics only works if you're not putting energy into the system. Well, we're constantly getting energy in from the sun. And that powers, that allows, you know, through the food chain, we have plants then going on to animals, it provides the energy for this. Because yes, evolution and natural selection does take energy, but the energy is constantly flowing in from the outside. So this is an old one, really. One of the oldest ones, oldest arguments was, or misconceptions, is that there are no transitional fossils. What's a transitional fossil? If you saw Jurassic Park, you know, they made it very clear at the end that the pelican looked like a dinosaur. Did it descend from the dinosaur? Well, yeah, sort of, a long time ago. Or directly? No, not directly at all. So that meant there had to be something between a dinosaur and a bird. That would be a transitional fossil. And the argument used to be, there are no transitional fossils. How can you say one came from the other? Two things. One is that the time periods they're talking about for transitional fossils is a relatively small geologic time period. The odds of finding them are very, very small. Number two, we found them anyway. in the case of the bird and if you've ever heard of Archaeopteryx, it's got scales, it's got claws, it's got teeth, and it's got wings with feathers on them, right? If you look at a bird today, the embryological origin of feathers is the same as the embryological origin of scales. It's exactly the same. So again, you can go to the biochemistry. There's lots of, and with man, again, that used to be the big one with man. What are you talking? Where's that missing link? Well, we have hundreds of missing links in our fossil record. So this one is just plain not true. It just shows a lack of the facts. And then this one too is a little bit disturbing, again, because it kind of leaves out part of what natural selection is. The misconception is, hey, evolution says that, well, I put light instead of life. It should be life. So the life originated and evolution proceeds by random chance. Well, is there some randomness involved in it or some chance? Yes, there is. Because again, which bacterium, who got the lucky gene that allowed them to survive the penicillin? Somebody had to get lucky. That's the chance part. But then the other part, the selection part, is very, very specific. You may have heard this I've heard this argument. Getting man through natural selection is the same as putting a bunch of monkeys in a room and getting them to type Shakespeare. You know, in other words, random hitting the keys, you'll never get it. It's because they think it's all random. They actually ran a computer simulation using the monkeys and using computer keys and using Shakespeare. By using the randomness of hitting the keys, but then selecting for the words that you wanted to keep and the words you wanted to throw out. And in something like 20 minutes, they got the word the or to be. And within a day, they got to be or not to be. Again, the randomness has to be there in first, but the selecting is the part that really, you know, fine-tunes it. So, it shows that they know part of what evolution means, the randomness, but the selection part is really the part that gets you and gets you really specific. So, these are misconceptions. Next, what I'd like to do is take you to a more historical look at some misinterpretations. And these are, most of them are a recent history. Again, Darwin, wrote the book in 1860. And something else that happened in that year was that's when Mendel came up with his genetic theory. And Darwin's book was published in 1860, but Mendel's work was buried for about 40 years. It didn't really resurface until the 1900s. You had a lot of strange science going on in that time period. One of the things, or two of the misinterpretations that I'm going to talk about, are social Darwinism and eugenics. Right? Social Darwinism. This refers to, it's a catch-all phrase, and it's a catch-all phrase that describes utilitarian philosophies that attribute human progress to unfettered competition among individuals. I could just see this British boardroom, the guys with their big cigars going, "Why, yes, we're here because we're better and we were selected for. They're there because they're scum and they're being eliminated from the population." In other words, they try to use Darwin's theory of natural selection and applied it to economic processes. They use it to justify cutthroat business practices. And it's sort of like, "Oh, look, it says in the book right here, so it has to be true, right?" It's a gross misinterpretation of using a biological Darwin. By the way, the ideas of crushing people who are less than you, that's been around forever. That obviously predates Darwin. The problem with using this type of a logic is that you have to be very, very, very careful when you're applying evolutionary standards to modern socialized man. The reason why? Modern socialized man. The one thing, man, people always say, how is evolution going to affect us? I don't know. Because it so much depends on the environment. The other thing is that man, probably more than any other animal, we have sort of sidestepped natural selection for the most part. Reason why? Is because we control our environment. You know, the environment is what does the selecting. But we've controlled our environment. We build a house so we don't freeze to death, so it doesn't make any difference how much hair we have on. The other thing that affects man's evolution is that a lot of people think that since we started getting a lot more socialized, that most of our evolution is cultural evolution. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that, like pretty much like what I just said, is that we started making clothes. So nature didn't have to select for the people that had the thickest fat or the longest hair, right? We started making weapons. So nature didn't have to select for the ones that were absolute strongest. You know, today, I mean, some little nerd can push a button and kill a city, right? What genes does he have? It has nothing to do with natural selection. The other thing, of course, that we do that's totally unique is that we pass on our behaviors through language. We have this really complex language, and we can pass it down instead of having to relearn everything every single generation. So with rare exceptions, we don't depend on our genes. The exceptions, of course, are things like diseases. Have we had a disease yet that wiped out the human population? Well, we had the bubonic plague. Today, though, we've got a lot of good antibiotics. So, we're controlling that aspect of our environment. So to get back to the social Darwinists, you had these people that were misinterpreting Darwin to justify their views. I'll name a few. Adam Smith, for example, everyone will benefit from laissez-faire capitalism. And he believed that all economic progress resulted from individual initiative rather than social initiatives. The reason why I have to mention social initiatives at this point is because you had the big shift from the country to the city. When you were living in an agrarian society, people took care of each other a whole lot better. You had the extended families, you had the neighbors, somebody got sick, you know, the extended family stayed together. When you moved to the cities, that whole social support system dropped out. So the question was, how much responsibility does the city, the state, the national government have towards taking care of citizens? And these guys said none at all. They said they're there because they have bad genes and nature means to weed them out. And we're here because we're special. Some more people who you might recognize. Malthus, I already mentioned him. Malthus was a very dour individual. He, besides saying that the population would outgrow the food supply, he also said that we're going to have winners and losers, and that's okay. He goes, nature needs to weed out, use those words, needs to weed out the unfit, and that's for the betterment of the entire society. Nice guy. W.G. Sumner said that nature eliminates inefficiency. Any interference with that will backfire. He thought welfare programs were interfering with natural processes. Herbert Spencer actually coined the phrase survival of the fittest. And in some of his quotes, he said that regulation slows progress and welfare programs will harm people in the long run. Some of the big boys, Carnegie, Rockefeller, James J. Hill, they would just publicly give speeches about justifying their own cutthroat business practices. And they used the term social Darwinism, which, by the way, Darwin never used that. It's just a made-up term. And you think about it, national policies. In the United States, we just thought that the blacks and the Indians would just die out because they were inferior. That was a national assumption that was going to happen. It was used to justify colonialism because we can go there and take over this country because those poor people don't really know what they're doing with their natural resources. Glad that stopped. It was used to invoke imperialism to justify racism, and they actually had something called scientific racism. And Ernst Haeckel showed in his pseudo books that there was a linear developmental pattern in races of modern men, and of course the Nazis just loved that. They picked that right up, and they had a whole bureau that would again use writings like his to justify whatever practices they decided to implement. Closely aligned with social Darwinism, also this was also coming up at the same time, was the practice of eugenics. Back in the late 1800s, Francis Galton, who was Darwin's cousin actually, coined this term eugenics. Galton was a very prolific guy. He did a lot of various types of scientific works, but he coined this term eugenics, comes from the Greek, eu means good genetics. And what he said was that fit humans produce fit offspring. And it's a waste to try to cultivate the unfit, just like plants. Humans should use selective breeding. I mean, this was, again, with the rediscovery of Mendel's work, people were reading this. That makes some sense, doesn't it? And Mendel's work offered a physical basis because Mendel said there were genes, so maybe there's genes for fitness and unfitness. If we eliminate the people that have these unfit genes, the whole population will be better, right? Unfit included people who had mental illnesses, schizophrenia, mental retardation, gross physical defects, criminals, and epileptics. Nobody knew what to do with the epileptics, And so they just said, they're crazy, let's lock them up, which is, pretty much what happened. something else that was invented at this time, right around the turn of the century, around 1910, was the IQ. The reason for the IQ was so that you could quantify intelligence. You could determine with a number who's going to get into such and such a college. And it stressed genetic over environmental factors. There were some pretty popular people that were supporting this. Positive eugenics said, let's have the fit make more children. People like Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, Calvin Coolidge, Winston Churchill, all said they were worried that the professional classes weren't producing enough children, committing race suicide. This is not made up stuff. This is all in the written work. Negative eugenics was much, much darker because it sought fewer children for the unfit. Now, we were just down at the Sarasota Film Festival a couple weeks ago, and they had a movie called War Against the Weak. And I sat there in the dark scribbling notes that were really a mess. But some of the things I got out of it, and I had a lot of stuff in there I didn't know. There we had a eugenic record office. The ERO was created in the United States. And it was actually funded by Andrew Carnegie. It was the basis for the founding of Cold Spring Harbor. It was originally a eugenics research place. One of its goals was to eliminate the lowest, by their definition, the lowest 10% of the population. All 48 states and many Western countries had sexual segregation of retarded folks during their reproductive years. Between 1900 and 1960, over 60,000 individuals in the United States were sterilized under compulsory programs. Upheld, by the way, in the Carrie Buck case by none other than Oliver Wendell Holmes. The girl, Carrie Buck, had a mother who was a prostitute. Carrie Buck was born from her. Carrie herself was raped, but they said she was promiscuous, and then she had a daughter. And the courts said, it's time to sterilize Carrie, it's time to sterilize her daughter, because we don't, this is Wendell's, this Holmes's quote, three generations of imbeciles is enough. You can read that case. Fortunately, Virginia repealed its, this is in the state of Virginia, repealed its sterilization law in 1974. During this time period, 35 U.S. states, many European countries, instituted compulsory programs, you're very familiar with these, sexual sterilization of mentally ill, retarded, again, criminals, epileptics, and in Germany it included Jews and Gypsies, and of course Germany moved into from sterilization to euthanasia. And murder. Eventually, the geneticists who were behind this bandwagon went, maybe we weren't 100% on the button here. And they really started backing off. They came to the realization, human heredity is a lot more complex than a set of genes or a set of simple behaviors. And of course, historically what happened was that the whole eugenics movement, which was very strong, by the way, this movie pointed out that Hitler read the work by the U.S., by the Cold Springs Harbor, when he was in prison. It didn't give him the idea, but it gave him the justification for his idea. What happened was after the, again, during the war and after the war, this whole eugenics movement started getting associated with Nazism, and it just got dropped. You don't see it anymore. But for a half century, governments used misinterpretation of science to form eugenic policies. So, there were a lot of strange things going on, especially, you know, the 1880s up to the 1920s. We had the eugenics movement. I think I have a few of these things up here. We had the evolutionary thinking was being associated with German militarism. So. People, maybe this evolution thing isn't so good because, you know, the Germans had it and you know what they're like, right? Again, at the same time, as a backlash, Protestant fundamentalism was increasing in reaction to religious liberalism in mainline Protestant denominations, and in 1925 we had the Scopes trial. Well, admit it.
You know about the Scopes trial from Inherit the Wind? Okay. That's where I learned about it. Great movie, great play. In 1983, I starred in Inherit the Wind in a barn theater in Ohio. And I was playing the William Jennings Bryan character, by the way. Well, the reason why I mention that is because the actuality of the Scopes trial was much different from what was portrayed. It was a wonderful dramatic interpretation, but it was a lot different from the reality. The reality was that, first off, it was never a normal criminal prosecution. What happened was the ACLU put ads in the paper. Say, anybody want to challenge this? And Scopes said, yeah, we'll do it. The folks in Dayton, Tennessee actually invited the ACLU there and said, would you prosecute him here? And everybody knows Dayton, Tennessee now, right, from that. Scopes never spent an hour in jail. And the funny thing was that the entire trial, nobody ever disputed that Scopes violated the law. Yeah, he was guilty. Everybody knew it, but it just gave the politicians and the papers a lot of time to publicize their own beliefs. And you know, his conviction, of course, was overturned. But the statute allowing evolution to be taught was ruled constitutional in Tennessee. After that, we had this 40-year time period, which brings us up to the 60s. What happened in the 60s? Sputnik happened in the 60s. We realized that this great science that we've been teaching was incomplete. We realized that the Europeans, specifically the Russians, knew a whole lot more math and science than we did, and there was a massive movement, which I really benefited from, to upgrade science education in the U.S. And as a matter of fact, the federal government started funding textbooks that included evolution, which of course stirred up some more conservative backlash. At this time, the Institute for Creationism research started, and they had their own textbooks. They didn't say creator, they didn't say God in them, but they had their own textbooks that supported this without actually using those words. Because of the several times that it was challenged when people were trying to include creationism, again, we're now into the 70s, it was thrown out. The Constitution, it was shown to be against the Constitution because it was teaching religion, which is against it. So, what about the U.S.? We've got a pretty wide spectrum of beliefs. You know, 9 out of every 10 Americans believe in spiritual causes for life. About half of them say they believe that God created humans in their present form. 40% believe that the human body evolved with God guiding the process, and about 10% opt for purely natural. Now, this is the general public, right? Among scientists, the numbers are completely reversed. In other words, the scientists are most support naturalistic evolution. Almost none accept special creation. So there's obviously a disconnect between the American public and the scientific community. The most recently, a group of kind of a loose group of Christian scholars have proposed that species are just too darn complex to have come about through evolution. They get major backing from a place called the Discovery Institute, based in Seattle, Washington. They have lots of big bucks. They're very, very politically savvy. And their main thrust is that because it's so complex, this whole process had to have a designer. A designer is required to account for the origins of living species. And of course, what I'm talking about here is intelligent design. They're very, very careful because they know that creationism is thrown out of courts, so they don't make any references to God. They say that science should not ignore supernatural causes for natural phenomena. And this sort of creates a special theological conundrum. I call it the God of the gaps. Because here's what happens. Basically, the philosophy behind intelligent design says, okay, we know this, we know this, we know this over here, but we don't really know this yet, therefore God's responsible for it. The problem with it is that what happens when you do know more of this, and you do know more of this, what you do, or what they do, is they make their God smaller. They haven't been able to work through that one quite yet. But if you know more, if you claim, I saw another problem with it, is that from now on, every answer on every test for every student could be God. Can't be wrong, right? Another one of the phrases that they use that you may see is the phrase, down here at the bottom, irreducible complexity. That's a great phrase. It's a principle of irreducible complexity. What it says is that biological systems, certain systems, are too complex to have evolved from simpler or less complete predecessors. I have my favorite cartoon. I actually had it made into a t-shirt. There it is. You can't see it in the back. This guy's working out this enormous physical math problem, and the guy says, then a miracle occurs. I think you should be more explicit here in step two. I might as well. So this all came to a head, this intelligent design thing, 2005. The case in Dover, Pennsylvania, district court. The teachers in that school system, it wasn't a very big school system, but they were instructed to, by their school board, to include intelligent design as an alternative for evolution. They refused because they said, the science teachers, only a couple, handful of science teachers, a small system, they said, no, that's religion. So they filed a lawsuit. Judge John Jones, who was a conservative Bush appointee, listened to a week's worth of testimony from intelligent design backers. The court case itself lasted 6 weeks, and the judge in his decision dismissed intelligent design entirely, calling it thinly disguised creationism. And it's a very, very good judgment that he made. And his decision is, it's very well written. One of the phrases he used was, he said, the school board acted with, quote, breathtaking inanity. When you're reading, especially in this area, there's a guy by the name of Michael Behe, B-E-H-E, who's one of the hired guns from this Discovery Institute in Seattle. And by the way, they use a lot of scientists, but they don't act like scientists, as scientists do. So he's got a PhD in, I think, maybe even biology. But during the course of it, basically the people that were saying we don't want intelligent design in the classroom didn't have to make a big argument. All they had to do was let the other people talk. And by the time they talked, they said so many stupid things that, again, the judge just threw them out. One of the things he ended up saying was, he said, well, could other types of almost science be included? And Behe said, yes, it could. And eventually, he ended up having to say on the stand that astrology would be just as permissible as intelligent design as an alternative science. Again, we're back to the demonic possession, right? There's a great PBS documentary that I really encourage you to, it's called Intelligent Design on Trial. You can either get it from the library. Intelligent Design on Trial is the name of it. It's very, very good. So, scientists, if you have a new idea and you want to get it into a textbook, this is what you do. You have this new idea. Novel scientific claim is the first. You make up a hypothesis. Okay? This is what I think happens. I'm going to show why it happens. You do research with repeatable results. This takes years. You have peer review. This is where you submit it to your peers and you say, here's what I think, and here's how I brought this all together, and I'm going to prove it. And that's where, of course, you get debates, writings, meetings. You accept your criticism. You counter-experiment. You try to establish that your idea has evidence behind it. Finally, if it gets that far, you reach a scientific consensus on your idea. You can get it published. You can then get it included in science textbooks. Intelligent design advocates have consistently acted to short-circuit this process. Those are 7 very long steps. They've shortened it to 2. This is true. I wish I was kidding. Come up with the hypothesis, put it in the textbook. That's it. And the textbooks that are out there show that, because there is, they haven't gone through that whole procedure. So, you know, if you come up with an alternative, you know, American history, oh, gee whiz, they would never do that. Yes, it's all you have to do is come up with it, and it's in a textbook, right? Now, I am not a, I'm going to wrap this up real quickly. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, right? But I do know that the easiest, quickest way, if somebody wants a position of power, an elected official in the United States, the easiest one to get is a school board. No qualifications. I think you have to be breathing. I'm pretty sure you have to be 18. But that's it. You know, the Europeans come over here and they go, so what's his doctorate in? What? He flunked phys ed in ninth grade and he's there because he doesn't like his gym teacher? Yep, that's how you can get elected to the school board. All right? You have a grudge against somebody? That's how you get elected to a school board. It's the most vulnerable and really super influential post. I mean, think about it. Kids, thousands of kids are going to be affected by what these people on a school board are going to come up with. So they use, by the way, this is the reason why I'm mentioning this again, it's associated with the intelligent design folks. They have a strategy. It's part of their strategy. It's called the wedge strategy, in which they try to just get a little bit of their stuff in, and they use the analogy of, we just put a wedge into this big tree of science, we can make it weaken and eventually fall down. So be aware of these things. You will never see, especially again with intelligent, you'll never see them presenting the arguments like scientists. They're pretty good with words. They're very good with sound bites. You know, they're pretty good with this, hey, equal time for us. But as far as going through the process and submitting their work to refereed science, they never ever do this. There is not one bit of evidence backing this up. And yet, they were making some pretty good inroads into getting this included in public school. You remember Alabama? Alabama had the stickers that they were forcing them to put on the books. It says, oh, this is only a theory, so just so you know that. You know, one of the people that was attacking that said, well, put that on everything, because everything's only a theory. You know, they're all subject to, they didn't want, all they wanted to do was attack the evolution part of it. Well, and of course, again, at the beginning of the program, Jim was saying, we're going to talk about intelligent design. And my answer to intelligent design is very nonverbal when people ask what I think of it. I just go like this. No. You know, where's the eyes in the back of my head? Where's the eyes on my fingertips? You know, where's the all the things? That would be cool. But no, this, also lining up with this, that I'll give myself a plug, and I don't know what quarter next year that I teach an 8-week course on this. I mean, this is really, really a kind of over, but I teach an 8-week course on this at Lifelong Learning Academy. Let me just say, in closing up, that if I had to pick two, a monumental, cataclysmic, man-made pronouncements in the history of the world, one would be, probably the number one would be Copernicus and Galileo coming up with the fact that we're not the center of the universe, that the Earth goes around the sun. I mean, can you imagine? Can you even imagine 2,000 years of this being taught in schools and people getting executed for challenging it, and they're going to prove that it's not true? I mean, it just had to shake the foundations of the establishment / church at the time. The other one, other pronouncement, isn't quite as big as that. It's kind of more quiet and more gradual, but, and it's not actually Darwin by itself, but it's very similar. What it says is, we are not the center of the universe or of this planet. We're part of it.